everybody. This is Again With This, episode 58. Let's watch a Laura Layton and Grant show in the CW's Dynasty. And now here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
What a gift. What a gift that was.
It truly is.
Truly.
This is the third time we're hearing it today, and it's still as amusing as ever. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Tara.
Let's watch Laura Layton and Grant show in the CW's Dynasty, why don't we?
Yes, let's.
And thank you, patrons, for joining us and for your support in making these bonus episodes possible and letting us let's watch all of these different things, which we love.
It's true.
So before we get into this episode, I'm just going to give you some background, because I don't assume anyone watches the show except for me. Like the original series, the CW's Dynasty is about a family that got phenomenally rich in the energy sector, although unlike the Carringtons of Denver from the 80s, the Carringtons of Atlanta have been moving away from that industry and are now mostly in media, I guess. I honestly, the details of their business dealings are not the parts of the show that hold my attention, really. So, yeah, that's when the little donkey in my head is, you know, playing a banjo or something. Our beloved Grant show is the new Blake Carrington. He has three children. Steven, a philanthropist who got written out of the show a couple of years ago. Adam, Sam Underwood, who was kidnapped as a baby and only recently came back to the family with a lot of bitter schemes. And Fallon, Elizabeth Gillies, the most determined to carry on the family's dynasty in the business world. And
great.
Surpass her father's achievements, which is going well, particularly lately, but I will get to that. So Blake is married to Crystal. He used to be married to a different Crystal, played by Natalie Kelly, but that Crystal died in a fire in the first season, and then we found out she wasn't actually Crystal and had borrowed the identity of a home healthcare worker played by Anna Brenda Contreras, and we all learned Blake had a type when she came to town, and he ended up falling in love with her and marrying her as well. And then in season three, she got recast with the current Crystal, Daniela Alonso, although there was a cute gag in the season four premiere, which I can't really clip because it was visual, but Fallon is yelling, "Crystal!" at a Latinx woman we've never seen before. It turns out she's referring to the Crystal wine glass this wedding planning is showing her hearty heart. They are very meta with all these recastings, by the way. And we are not done with Blake's recast wives, because before either of the Crystals, Blake was married to Alexis, who left the family when Fallon was fairly young. Initially, she was played by Nicolette Sheridan, and then Adam pushed her face first into a fire. And while producers figured out who they wanted to replace Nicolette Sheridan with permanently, the story was that Adam had her reconstructive surgery modeled on Fallon's face, on whom at that time he had an incestuous crush. So for a time, Alexis was played by Gillies in age makeup, but eventually they landed on her former co-star on Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, Elaine Hendricks, who remains
in
the
role.
Of Romy and Michelle in The Parent Trap with Dennis Quaid, her. Mm-hmm. She's great. Other notables in the cast, Sammy Joe, Rafael De La Fuente, originally played by La Locklear on the first series, but now the nephew of one of the Crystals and ex-husband to Steven, which pretty cold they wrote out the actual Carrington, but kept Sammy Joe. He is good, though. There's also Dominique Devereaux, played by Michael Michelle. She is Blake's half-sister. Jeff Colby, Sam Adegoke, Dominique's tech billionaire son. Culhane, Robert Christopher Riley, formerly the Carrington driver and Fallon side piece, now the owner of Atlanta's pro soccer team, and Anders, Alan Dale, majordomo of Carrington Manor and Blake's surrogate father. So let us go through this episode's plot lines. I will provide the background that you need to know along the way. Starting with our E plot, Jeff and Culhane fight over some broad. So Culhane met Mia. She works at a nonprofit at a charity event. He arrived very early, and he was like, "Well, I'm here. I guess I'll help set up," and took off his jacket. And so she thought he was a waiter, and he was like, "Well, I'll just go with it to be helpful." He kept it up after she said she wasn't into rich guys, which he is. Turns out she's the ex-girlfriend of his friend Jeff, and when they all figured out what was happening, she told them she would be fine dating both of them, and they thought they were as well. But then they just spend this episode upstaging each other on their dates with huge, obnoxious, rich guy gestures, which, you know, I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on this. I like both of these dudes, especially Jeff. I think Adegoke is a much better actor than Riley, but they're both fun. But the woman playing Mia is pretty terrible. And if this is the end of her, I will not miss her. But the only reason this is important really is because their plot line ends up with them figuring out what's going on in the B plot, which we will get to. Mm-hmm. Sarah, your thoughts on the E plot?
It was beautiful to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the rest of the show, like what is actually going on plot wise is so immaterial that it's like, I think the show has a pretty good idea of what it is.
Yes.
By this point, that's my sense.
Yep.
When I first watched this reboot, I was like, I will never leave a room in which this is on, but I don't need, like, I'm not going to keep up with it and I don't need to, but I might start because like everybody's wardrobe and makeup is like, even when it's bad, it's like super watchable.
Yep.
And the show just like has a great ear for what it is and what it needs to do. And it understands that this is the E plot and it doesn't drag it out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a perfect Friday night show. Like it's just relaxing. Like it's what you want at the end of the week, like to not have to think hard about it and to like tune out of the stuff that is less interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
All right. Moving on. Our D plot. Crystal may be dying. So until pretty recently, Blake and Crystal's marriage had been on the rocks. She hated how much he worked or something. Who cares? And she had an affair with a priest. Also, Danielle Alonso was wildly pregnant and Crystal wasn't. So there was a lot of very funny, unconvincing cropped shots and giant purses. But like because of how the show is, like it's almost like that was a meta storyline to itself. Like, how are they going to hide her pregnancy in this scene? But anyway.
Love it.
As soon as the two of them got over themselves and realized they were still in love, Crystal found out she had a brain tumor. And in this episode, Adam tells her it's probably inoperable and that she should start letting her loved ones know what is up. And since this is pretty much all we see of Adam in this episode, you would never know he's totally a murderer. He killed the woman who kidnapped him, which, like, I don't know, fair, I guess. But he also sold prescriptions, got his medical license revoked. When he became a vet instead, he just started treating his quasi-adoptive mother's pain with animal tranquilizers. I already mentioned how he burned Alexis's face off. He also gave Jeff a neurological disorder by having his office painted with poison paint. Like, I can't tell if they're trying to redeem Adam now, even though he's one of the campier characters. I just find his scheming exhausting, particularly since he's still around, living in the Carrington Manor, despite all the shit he has pulled, so that change would be welcome in one respect, but I feel like they're counting on so much plot happening that we just forget all the truly quite bad stuff he has done. I have not, but anyway.
I hated this character on sight, and I couldn't figure out why. The answer was in his IMDb entry. He was on the following.
Oh.
The Poehead and I have notes.
There we go.
He's very good at playing a bratty schemer.
Yeah.
That you hate and want to fall down a mine.
Mm-hmm.
More on that later. But good casting.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little shit, that guy.
He is.
Always.
Yeah. So it seems like Crystal's about to tell Blake about her tumor, but then she sees Blake forgiving Adam for more shady shit he did. Doesn't matter. And decides she doesn't want to put more worry on Blake. Sarah, are you so worried about Crystal's brain?
Don't care.
Great.
Least favorite plot. She's not a good actress. Next.
Moving on to our C plot. Kirby's boyfriend's back and he's got blow. Speaking of the seeming attempt to rehabilitate Adam's character, Kirby, who is Anders' daughter, keeps talking about how boring Adam is. Like, babe, I don't know if you need Mickey from Natural Born Killers, but Adam is not boring by most people's standards.
Yeah, he might not be straight, but
well,
that's not boring.
On the same tip, Alexis has hired Kimberly's Australian ex to come to town and try and break up Kirby and Adam because Alexis doesn't think Kirby is good enough for her boy, the murderer. Anyway, this dude's name is Oliver. He's a fashion photographer or possibly a fake fashion photographer in The Grift. It's unclear.
He's not an actor, I'll tell you that for free.
Actually, I saw him on TikTok and he was pretty funny, so he might just be a comedian. He's not Australian, I don't think. But he had a substance abuse issue when he and Kirby dated. Now he's sober-ish. He basically peer pressures Kirby into doing coke with him by saying she's boring now, and it totally works. Sarah, what if Kirby becomes a cokehead? 15 exclamation marks and question marks.
I don't know. It's mid-season, right? Seems right on time.
Yes. Usually they have 22 episode seasons. Obviously, last season was short because of the pandemic. I don't know how many are in this season, but yeah, mid-season, more or less.
Okay. It's time.
Fair. Now we're getting into the meat of the episode, our B-plot.
Oh, yeah.
Dominique and Alexis are trapped in a time and mind on Carrington property. This is so complicated to backstory. I'll try to keep it brief. Jeff and Alexis entered into a marriage of convenience to ruin Blake's company because they both hate him, and it worked. They even forced him out of the manor. There was something mineral rights. Alexis was convinced she could mine for diamonds on the property, and she set up a whole operation. But then Blake, who knew there were not any diamonds, conspired with Dominique to trick Alexis into thinking there were, and the house was falling apart, so she should unload it rather than get stuck with the repair costs. Blah, blah, blah. Blake outmaneuvered Alexis and left her with nothing, including the marriage to Jeff. And Alexis and Dominique ended up in the mine together in the previous episode where they had a physical, classic, like, old dynasty, like, knockdown, drag-out physical fight, also with yelling, causing a cave-in at the entrance, which is why we find them there in this episode. So I enjoy seeing these two divas bickering. This is not a character pairing we've seen very much of. They have a good, sparky energy. I'm going to play clip one, and then we can discuss it. Clip one.
The reality is that none of our kids care enough to find us. It's just you and me. So I'll say it one more time. Get your child neglecting ass over here and move a rock.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead.
I would happily be trapped in this mine with both of them,
mm-hmm.
which shocking to me because I was like, Michael, Michelle.
I know.
Are we still fucking trying this? Well, it finally worked.
Yes.
Like, Homicide, I was like, I see what they're trying to do, but no. And then ER, I was like, string of ones and zeros, no. At last, we have arrived at Michael Michelle's lane.
Yeah.
And I would like to drive it as fast as possible. Like, she looks great. She has great, like, hate each other buddy movie chemistry here mm-hmm. with Elaine Hendricks. Elaine Hendricks is the fucking best. They have so many, like, funny jokes about, like, you know, the miners left this care package down here, and she's like, oh, there's so much gluten in these bars, and, like, they're back and forth about, like, confessing to each other about all the shit that they've pulled, because it's, like, they think it's their deathbed, basically.
Yeah,
and,
well, I got,
like,
a clip of that,
to bring
too,
a viewer up to speed that I was, like, that is what makes me say that this show understands exactly what it is and does that thing, which is almost a parody of The Thing, which is also the same as The Thing,
mm-hmm.
extremely well. Like, it obviously cares deeply for this genre, which it also acknowledges is not that important, but it cares enough to do it as well as it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to these, like, you know, I like, hate fucked such and so, and to get back at bloody blah, and, like, they know full well that I'm down here and they're just not going to come get me kind of stuff, like, I just thought it was so good. Like, it's really nice to see a show. I'm trying to think of a movie like this, but there are certain movies that are like, I guess this is a B minus. Like, AFI is not going to, you know, lift it up to the pantheon, but, like, for what it's trying to do,
mm-hmm.
it does it extremely, like Die Hard 2, for example.
Sure.
It's like, that is a, like, right down the fairway, extremely satisfying sequel.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's still like an 83, but it's for what it is, it's great, and you don't have to pay full attention. These scenes were my favorite. I wish it were a bottle episode of them stuck down there. It's great.
Yeah, it's the same creative team, to speak to your point of, like, knowing what they're doing as Gossip Girl and the new Gossip Girl. And, like,
yeah.
what this has that Gossip Girl doesn't is, like, wit. Like, it's
yeah.
trying to be funny. It has all the, like, crazy soapy bullshit too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also funny, like, and it is effectively funny, which Gossip Girl was just like, oh, this is trying to be so, like, the way kids are today, all in all caps, where it's like, no, like just relax, like, take your foot off, yeah. off the gas.
No, like, no one is here for that kid or adult.
Right.
So, yeah, I think the CW, this is on the CW, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the CW has understood for a while, sort of generally programming wise, that this is its lane, that it's like,
yeah,
it's just not that serious.
Like, yeah.
the old Charmed was like, that, you know, this is about family and holding hands across the veil. And the new Charmed was like, it's witchcraft. Like, it's rad.
Yeah.
Where, can anyone have some fun?
Yes.
So I've liked that about many CW properties, even if I don't keep up with them, including, like, this is a weird comparison, but, like, Legends of Tomorrow has this energy.
Yeah.
That it's like, we're, you know, we have superpowers and we could cross time. Like, have a smile on. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. I agree with you. Like, the CW is very clear on what its brand identity is. And the only other network I can think of that is as clear is, I mean, FX is pretty good usually. Like, you can tell an FX show in a lineup, but Freeform.
Yep. For sure.
Anyway, back to the B plot. So Dominique and Alexis bond over their very bad relationships with their children. As Sarah said, neither is convinced anyone's going to come looking for them because they fucked things up so badly. And when it seems like the end is imminent, Dominique tells Alexis her biggest secret, which is she's still married to her last husband and he doesn't know. And in response, Alexis tells Dominique about another affair she had during her marriage to Blake. The first one was Anders and produced Steven. This one also ended in a pregnancy when she had the baby, a daughter, in secret and gave it to a distant relative. Clip two.
And now I have a second cousin who I barely know, who is actually my daughter.
I don't have anything snarky to say, Alexis. Deserved or not, we've both experienced a lot of pain.
Oh, but then, once Jeff and Culhane, the only people alive who care about them at all, realize something may be wrong because I haven't heard from either of them in a while and come and rescue them, Dominique tells Alexis, actually, her confession was a lie, which maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. We certainly don't know. Either could be fine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm glad that you like this plot line because my question here was, what was it like watching Michael Michelle act well for a change? And you've already answered it.
Yeah. I mean, there's some line where she's like, severed finger.
Yeah. In.
Yeah. Like, she just had moments. There were glimmers in both Homicide and ER of, like, I think because those were procedurals and she felt like she was sort of having to, like, be cop-like or doctor-like, and then there's a lot of medical lingo and specific blocking. Like, I just think that she was, like, so far off of who she actually is that it just ended up flatline. But there were moments in both where it was like, she could probably do this if she didn't have to be a detective or a doctor.
Right.
Shit, like, you know, and she's like, she was always pleasant to look at. That was never the problem.
Yes.
But, like, you put her in 5-inch heels and smudge her up a little.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. It was fun.
It's
really
true.
Fun.
You're not even getting the full Dominique experience because she's so deglammed for the entire episode from start to finish. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, Elaine Hendricks in that dress until the end of the episode, which that she's like, and here I am on my one high heel, like,
yeah,
at a girl. It's I mean, yeah, it's great.
Finally, our A plot is La Layton going to fuck up Fallon's IPO? Finally, the reason that we're here. So while Blake got tricked out of his business, Fallon still has hers, although she's in a huge amount of debt due to some real estate stuff from the previous episode. Not important. Now she needs this IPO to be a giant success to help her get out of the hole. And so she and Blake, who now works for her, strategize in clip three.
I mean, I know that it's a risky move to go public in order to cover debt, but...
Risky is when I let the Tesla self-drive with my eyes closed for fun. This is way beyond that.
Look, SEC approval for this usually averages around 25 days, but I need it to happen in two.
Okay. Whose palms do we need to grease?
The palms of my assigned SEC officer.
Oh, Corinne Simpson. We used to winter together in St. Bart's. Nope, I misread Corinne Simon. Don't know her. Sorry.
I know Corinne Simon.
Liam is behind a whiteboard in the room.
How long has he been in here?
He's quiet.
Corinne's an old Van Kirk family friend. I'd be happy to make a call when I take my next break. I'm researching a few potential stories. Or I can take my break now.
So, Sarah, this is your first glimpse of Liam, Fallon's husband, played by Adam Huber. What did you think of him, and did my complaining about him on Extra Hot Grade over the years prejudice you at all? Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, that sweater was the most interesting thing about him. It looked extremely cozy. Mm-hmm. But it was also oatmeal,
yeah,
like him. Fallon, you can and probably have done better. Do better.
Yeah.
You're Fallon. Yes. You're the best.
She is the best. I mean, we'll get back to her. But yeah, my problem with him, and I've written about this and I've said it on Extra Hot Grade, so if you haven't listened to that or read my previous articles, he doesn't know. He's the most off tone in his performance. Mm-hmm. Like he's not big enough. It's like he doesn't know it's a soap.
Yeah, no, he thinks he's in a Herskovitz property. Like,
yeah.
No, sir.
Mm-hmm. So Blake and Fallon are pretty sure they know how to get to Corinne to expedite the IPO. Bribes. Clip 4.
Somewhere after surf, but well before turf, I'll just casually mention that Fallon Unlimited needs the review process accelerated.
And if we've sufficiently charmed her, she'll think it's all her idea. It'll be smooth sailing. Mm-hmm.
I think you may need to drop your anchor for a second. I just spoke with some old VKI colleagues. Turns out Corinne helped my father take VKI public back in the day. And this extravaganza's got to go.
What? Why? Who doesn't like a little special treatment?
Corinne, anything even resembling a bribe will end this faster than you can say chowder.
Well, I would never say that, fast or slow.
Who said anything about a bribe? This is just a casual dinner with a woman who happens to love New England seafood. Trust me, this is how things are done.
Trust me, my father is the one who knew her. But hey, if you won't listen to my advice, I don't need to be here tonight.
Okay, fine. Well, 86 the tanks, and the chefs, the helm, and, you know, anything that feels nautical or bribey. And that means you too, Blake.
What? Why do I have to go?
I mean, Blake Carrington in the room will smell fishier than that seafood tower I just saw wheeled in.
Yeah. I'm sorry, but I trust Liam.
Fine. Come running to me when things go south. I'll be getting my house back in order, and I am taking this lobster with me. Can someone bring me some melted butter?
King.
So I'm not going to do a whole visual aids just for that one, but I did make a GIF of Blake picking up the lobster and walking out with it. So go to @AWT90210 on Twitter to see that in all its glory, because
oh god,
I feel like they somehow knew you were going to watch this one and included that lobster just for you, Sarah.
Oh yeah. Now I want lobster roll again.
I bet you can make that happen.
I bet I can.
So sadly, this is it for the comedy stylings of Blake and Fallon in this episode. So what is your ruling on these two and their father-daughter chemistry?
I think it's actually pretty good. Like, sometimes, like, TV generally doesn't, I think, understand how fathers and daughters are a lot. It's like how I'm always saying, like, is every writer's room all only children? Like, I know for a fact it isn't. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes sibling relationships are so weird.
Yeah.
And then, especially on a soap, like, that can be off-tone really quickly, but then you figure out that they're not, like, biologically related, whatever else.
Right.
I thought it was good. There was like that fond exasperation note that you want.
Mm-hmm. On both their sides. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, Grant Cho is a pro and Fallon is just like such a watchable character. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was good.
I love that they're the same height when she's in heels, too. Like, mm-hmm. When we heard in that clip when they both say New England seafood in unison, like they're in a two shot, just like their heads. Exactly the same height. They're so funny.
Yeah.
But Blake and Corinne aren't going to meet. Boo! So I did notice on my third time through this episode, which I watched twice before this to prepare for my Laura Layton interview, she only has scenes with Liam and Fallon. Even her assistant that we see later on does not appear with Corinne at all. So I assumed it was COVID-related, like maybe they limit the exposure that regular cast has to guest stars because the guest stars are not getting tested as often as they are, maybe.
Right.
And I know we know Grant Cho and Laura Layton dated, and of course it's impossible to not to speculate that they didn't want to be in a scene together, but I also feel like if the blood were that bad, either he would have vetoed her appearance because he's a producer on the show, or she mm-hmm. would not have done it. Like, she called him my friend Grant when I talked to her, which makes me smile even now remembering. It was sweet.
Right.
And I didn't get the sense
that
it was just
so long ago. Like, if the blood is still that bad, like, Jesus.
She's been married to Doug Savant for so long, like, their daughter just got married. Like, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But she really sounded proud of him and the show's success, and it's not like they're not both living their best lives with their respective hot soap opera star spouses, because they are. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it was, like, either of them.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I'll do it, but I'm not going to be in the scene. Back to this plot. Fallon has Corinne over for the very, very quiet dinner that Liam recommended. Clip 5.
I have to admit, the lack of frills tonight was refreshing.
Well, this is how we eat most nights, you know, frill-less.
Well, you wouldn't believe what some CEO types try to ply me with.
Fancy seafood, pricey vintages of champagne, live lobster.
Point made, darling.
Shut up, Liam. No one cares.
Seriously. Know your role.
So Corinne brings up stupid Liam's stupid dead dad and some crisis he was in right before he died, and then clams up, no seafood dinner, pun intended. But Liam is a journalist, and he is intrigued. And Sarah, I know you're new to the show since we watched it for the podcast, but trust me, no one cares about Liam, never mind his dad, who died before the events of the show. Nevertheless, no one asked me, and now we have to live with it. So Liam thinks that Corinne was unethically tipping people off about whatever his dad was involved in, and Fallon is like, leave it alone, please. You are fucking with my billion-dollar business. And he has, like, I have a job, too. Not really. And the next time we see Corinne, it's to come yell at Fallon about Liam investigating her behind Fallon's back. So the next time Fallon and Liam are together, they have a fight about it. Clip 6.
This is a real story, Fallon. A meeting with a former VKI colleague of my dad's who's behind bars for insider trading. I don't know, maybe he was set up too.
And what is this loser's name?
You don't know him. His name's Harold. And technically, I did just as you asked. I didn't reach out to Corinne.
Oh, really, Liam? A loophole defense? Obviously, Corinne was going to find out, which she did, and threatened to hold up my approval, which she also did.
Wait, Corinne's holding your approval hostage? I mean, Fallon, right there, that's basically an admission of guilt.
I don't care if she admitted to shooting Lincoln, Liam. I need her stamp of approval to move forward. I mean, do you have any idea what I have riding on this? We're supposed to be a team.
No. If we were a team, you wouldn't ask me to sacrifice something you know I have a personal stake in. I know you make more money than I do, but my goals aren't any less important than yours.
Actually, this time they are less important, and that's just something you're going to have to deal with.
No, I don't think it is. I need to find the truth out about my father. And I hope you'll find a way to support me.
No one cares about your journalism career, Liam!
Well, and also, if it's about your dad, like, if you didn't know for this long, what's another 36 hours?
Right.
Go stand in your charger and like the grown-ups are talking.
Right. Ugh. Also, if it's about your dad, maybe hand it off to someone else to report because you're too close to the story.
Yeah.
But then Crystal gives Fallon a framed copy of her wedding invitation, and Fallon realizes people who are married need to be a team, but she's still her and can't change on a dime. Clip 7.
I was just at the prison, and you had the nerve to call me deceitful. Maybe you can explain to me why the only thing that Harold Duffy seemed to remember was the finale of The Sopranos.
Would you please stop? You're embarrassing
Mallory, and I'm fine.
I know what you did, Fallon. Your name was on the visitor's log.
Okay, well, they promised me they weren't going to show you that.
I just love that they had to seed it in the previous clip where he's like, what's this loser's name? Like, oh, that's why she asked. Not just because she was curious. There was a reason.
You don't know him. His name's Harold. He's Canadian, like me and my colleagues.
Worse. So Fallon makes Liam come in with her as she tells Corinne she's going to withdraw her IPO application and resubmit it with someone else that isn't going to mess with it because she trusts and supports Liam, and whatever dirt he wants to dig up on Corinne is fine with her. But things are not as they seem. Clip 8.
We are a team. Corinne is the villain here.
holding my company hostage to cover your ass? I hope you look good in prison sweats.
You have it all wrong.
Or do I have it all right?
I never should have stalled your application. I'm sending it through immediately. And I was trying to steer Liam away from this investigation, but not for the reasons you think. I was protecting you.
I don't want your protection. I just want to know the truth.
The truth is your father was caught up in a powerful insider trading ring, and he confessed to me, hoping I could help him expose it.
Why don't you tell someone?
Because things got scary. And I have a family of my own. A family I'm putting in danger by telling you this, even now. After what happened to John.
What do you mean, what happened to John?
Liam, I'm so sorry, but I don't believe your father's death was an accident. I think he was murdered.
So no one cares. I can't keep saying it more. And yet, this is not just a huge deal to Liam, but a turning point in his marriage to Fallon, as he takes off to go on a reporting trip, even as she says she doesn't want him to for the sake of his safety, but he does it anyway. And this is a good time to note that this
Maybe
season
he'll
opened,
die.
Yeah, exactly. This season opened with a flash forward funeral. And at first, the only one we saw was Fallon sitting by the graveside. But as the season has gone on, we've seen more people come in and join her. So by this point, we know the dead person is not Sammy Joe and it's not Adam. But it could be it still be Liam. And I really hope it is because I'm sick of this guy's shit. So, Sarah, let us close this up. What is your review of Grant's show as Blake?
He's good. I think he has just the right tone, not too serious. He looks great. Both he and Laura Layton look their ages, yep. but look great. Like, and it's funny that on such a sort of glammy show like that, that they're sort of finding a way to like not, they just don't look too plasticky. Elaine Hendricks also.
Yeah, I agree. He also looks really good in suits. Like those suits mm-hmm. are
That's true.
He tailored. Does. So well. They all look fabulous on him. You already mentioned how she looks. What was your review of Laura Layton as Corinne?
As usual, bringing 100% to the material. Like, that last clip that we heard is, like, there's no reason for her to be that good.
Yeah.
She could have done, like, 71% of that, and it would still have been great. But she's a pro.
Yep. We've touched on this a little bit as we've been discussing it. The fashion.
Okay, there are some Fallon lip outline stories that I'm not crazy about. But other than that, it's just like so, it's like mouthwatering to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Even stuff that I'm like, ugh. Like Kirby's blazer in that one scene with the appliques. I was like, do I hate that or do I want to buy it? Turns out both, like I was on eBay looking for similar ones, but also hating it kind of.
Yeah.
It's so much fun to look at. And the show, to its credit, understands that that's part of what it's for. Mm-hmm. And it gives you some nice, and credit to the cast too, because there's some blocking that's like, that's not how people stand with a purse, but they're trying to make sure you see that it's Yves Saint Laurent. So it's like, okay, I saw that. And I'm mentioning it now. Well done.
Yeah, I think more so than any other show I watch, this is one where I go and look up. I mean, not that I'm going to ever be able to buy a Fallon Gucci suit that she wears
no.
or have any occasion to have it if I could buy it, which I couldn't. But I like more so than any other show I watch, this is one where I like research where the pieces are from and they are all, oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Her jewelry, too. Like there's a pair of fly earrings she wore a couple seasons ago where it's like, crying because they were so gorgeous. And on the show in general, I feel like you touched on this before we got into all the storylines, but it seems like you're pro.
Yes, very pro. I mean, yeah, like anything worth doing is worth doing well. And like maybe it's quote just a soap, but like they I don't know, they respect the art, I feel.
That's a great way to put it. So if someone, me, were to suggest that we watch the musical episode at a future date, you would not be mad about it, it sounds like?
I would not be mad about that at all.
Fantastic. What a great place to end.
I'm not sure how much I'm going to be able to do here.
I think we can manage.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With Again With This, episode 81. Let's watch Laura Layton in the Name of Love, a Texas Tragedy. And now, here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hello, Patreon supporters. Welcome back to another episode of Again With This. Thank you so much for, quote, making us watch yet another true crime crossover event, In the Name of Love, a Texas Tragedy, a 1995 made-for-TV movie that appeared on Fox. This is based on a true story. I was shocked to find, going through the inventory of my true crime bookshop, that there is no, like, book that's the standard for this. They just, like, rip this from the headlines. In real life, it was more like In the Name of Freud, a Mississippi Tragedy. It is, quote, loosely based on the case of Ralph Hand III and his late wife, Olivia Browning, spoiler, whom Hand III was accused of killing and was alleged to have done so on the orders of or under the influence of his father, Big Ralph, a.k.a. Ralph Jr.
Sure.
Camden, New Jersey's own Big Ralph, after an amour fou, much like the one cataloged here, went sour in the late 80s. But the story that we see is as follows. Luke Constable, Michael Hayden of the New York stage and all three primary Law & Order properties, has a bright future ahead of him as the scion of the Constable family. Or really, his grandfather, Lucas Prime, played by Richard Crenna, who, along with Luke's Aunt Alice, the great Bonnie Bartlett, a.k.a. Mark Green's mom on ER and Ellen Craig on St. Elsewhere, raised him after the implied death by suicide of his father. This opaque death is the subject of one stilted obloquy. Many others follow, in which family members exposit at one another about facts that would already be in evidence. Or dinner parties take place in near monastery silence so as to point up, in theory, the bad manners of an interloper, Laura Layton, but in practice, the bad manners of the upper crusties. There's also a lot of 80s teen movie class war shortcutting that didn't really play back then and certainly doesn't now. The writing really seems to crib from some of John Hughes's worst instincts. Clip two.
Who is that anyway?
How would I know? Lorette something. She went to the public school, and everybody says she's trash, Luke.
Moments later, a DUI accident robs Luke of the use of his legs and his then-fiancé the use of her free will. After this, Luke's friends try to arrange a one-night stand between him and Lorette. Laura Layton, who is making better headway against Texas accentry than most in the cast, but that's not to say that it's good.
No.
But they're both into each other for real, much to the dismay of Lucas Prime, who spends the rest of the movie trying to scrape the barnacle he sees as Lorette off the hull of the good ship Luke. Most of the "she's not our kind" signifying is so ham-handed that you'll long for a slice of Swiss to cut the fat, but Bonnie Bartlett is always a pro, and no more so here than in this scene, which succeeds, at last, in conveying the freeze-out in play, thanks to the actors. Clip three.
Honey, you don't have to do this. The gardens will take care of it.
That's all right. I like putting my hands in the dirt once in a while.
It's all been designed. All these little plantings are carefully color-coordinated. So would you mind just taking all this stuff back to the shed, please?
I thought this house belonged to Luke and me.
Well, the ranch becomes his only after his granddaddy and I are dead. Didn't he tell you that?
Must not have seen a reason to.
Well, it should have been talked about before the marriage. Then you all were in such a hurry, you wouldn't listen to anybody.
Do you think if I'd have known that, I wouldn't have married him?
So, yeah, it's the old boy meets girl. Girl naively thinks she doesn't marry the whole family when we all know you always do. Girl wants boy to declare his independence from the family. Boy divorces girl instead, but they can't stay away from each other. So girl's like, it's them or me. Boy's like, well, they canceled my charge card, so I guess it's them. Girl leaves. Boy kills girl, quote, accidentally.
Girl dies in a tragic blimp accident. Goodyear? No, the worst.
I mean, kind of. There are some Hindenburg elements. Boy builds a pyre to hide the crime, even though it's broad daylight.
It's noon. Like, it is
noon.
It's so bright.
It is the highest of noons. Boy gets caught. Boy is imprisoned. Boy only does a third of his sentence and then dies of a heart attack at age 45. Story. Although we don't get that last part.
Right.
In this movie. Yes, if this sounds to any of you natives of the Deep South, like the tragic marriage of Ralph Hand III and Olivia Browning, that's roughly the outline the story follows. It's not actually that loose a basis. It's pretty close. Olivia was probably somewhat less ambiguous a Hellcat than Leighton's Lorette. We'll have a bunch of links in the show notes, including a long Washington Post read all about the case that is written very floridly, but is still actually better than this movie. But the movie, I will say, does try to see Lorette's side, at least. But it's not good. I thank our friend and esteemed colleague Antho Buzz for uploading this fine feathered copy that we watched. But Leighton and Bonnie Bartlett are basically the only good things about it, and there's not that much story. It's just not enough story for an hour and 24 minutes. Tara, thoughts?
Well, the funny thing about it, and I guess it's mostly because the story is kind of the same every time it happens, but it has a lot of the same beats as House of Gucci, weirdly, except the, you know, who kills whom is flipped. But it's a similar thing where it's like a lot of the things that Lorette is trying to tell Luke about, you know, the ways he should consider changing his life aren't wrong. Like, at a certain point, we find out that he does not even get paid a salary by his grandfather for doing what seems to be full-time work on this farm. Like, it's just assumed, you know, you're going to get it when I die. So, like, whatever. But it's not clear, like, does he get an allowance? Like, how does he just pay for stuff? I mean, that's before, you know, they try and go on the run, and then they get to the motel and find out, JK, they already called in your credit card and canceled it. And then while they're inside the motel, they also sent like their main ranch hand to like go and take back their car or his Luke's vehicle. Yeah. And it was just like, damn, like, I get it, I guess, but harsh. So, you know, she's not wrong. The issue is that she's not coming to it from the right background.
Right.
And if she were in the right background, she wouldn't be saying these things, because she would just assume all the same things that Luke is supposed to about how life works.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, I mean, the sort of, there's a space at the core of this story, even in real life, where it's just like not entirely clear who made whom do what or why. Because at the end of the day, like, the dad slash grandfather figure did not pull the trigger.
Right.
And there's a lot of signifying in the real story about, like, well, you know, she was she was sleeping around on him. She was abusive towards him. He required certain tools in order to get around, and she would throw them in the lake.
Right.
You don't see that as much here, but there's still that. It's just a little confusing to me. Like, I think we're supposed to side with both of them against the dad.
Absolutely, or yes.
The grandpa.
Yeah.
But then, like, yes, the grandpa is horrible, but he didn't kill her, and there's no suggestion that he told Luke to kill her either.
Right.
So, yeah, it's like, and also, you know, once the conflict is set up between the classes and the two families, it's like, you know, there's only so many iterations of the same fight
exactly,
that you see.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, the story in real life was a lot more sort of like, you know, gothic and dramatical, and they got back together and split up a lot more times. And But yeah, the accents are not good. I feel like the way the class divisions are set up, like there are some moments like Bartlett being like, you don't have to redo these plantings. And in fact, we have our own waspy way that we want it done. So quit right. touching it.
Yes.
That's a little closer to authenticity, I guess. But
yes. Well, you can hear it in that clip you pulled because, you know, it's her, it starts out very sunny. She's like, oh no, don't trouble yourself with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Edge is like, do not do this. Don't wreck our shit.
Right.
And the other, there's an earlier scene too, where like Luke has decided he wants to get out on his own. And that means moving into the back house, which we also heard about in this clip, which is like still on the property. So like, of course it's not his. It's, you know, it will be one day, but it's not right now.
And it's a huge Craftsman bungalow also, like,
yeah. But they, you know, she's very excited about, you know, furnishing it. She's like, we can do this here. And then when they get back after their honeymoon, it's already all full of a bunch of old lady furniture that's been like in storage somewhere. And she's like, I hate it. And, you know, as a viewer, you're like, yeah, it's ugly. Like,
yeah,
this looks like it was the original furniture that was here when this house was built in 1896 or whatever. Like, it's just all.
Yeah, just a lot of like wagon wheel spoke back chairs and.
Right. But also, like, you know, Victorian, just big, heavy, dark. It actually makes the space look dark. Like, all of it is just very fussy. You know, it looks like the aunt's gift because it is, because it's all her taste. But,
yeah.
I mean, in terms of the title, like, it is kind of a Texas tragedy because you do feel whether this is in line with what the real events that it's based on or not. And it sounds like not really. We do feel that they love each other, but they're trapped by their circumstances and neither of them knows how to get past it. Like, she's more of a, Lorette is definitely more of a survivor. Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that she could figure out how to break free of this family, but Luke just doesn't know where to start. And so, like, literally the first night when they have setbacks, he's like, well, I give up, you know, because he also is, you know, he's self-conscious and traumatized by the accident, too, and doesn't feel like he's worthy. And like, he has this disability now, like he's not fully paralyzed, but he walks with braces. Mm-hmm. And so he has a lot of like self-consciousness and defensiveness about that, which also happens on their honeymoon trip where he's like, everyone's looking at you and I'm just this cripple who's with you or blah, blah, blah. And I think a lot of that is down to the performances by Hayden and Leighton because they really get inside these characters. Like, I didn't think it was as bad as you did. I didn't think it was great. But it, for me, like, all of these 90s true crime miniseries and TV movies are, like, kind of the same. Like, they have a lot of...
They basically are.
Yeah. Like, they have a certain formula that they hew to that is very pleasing. Like, whenever we watch one of these, I always feel... It makes me feel nostalgic for a time when we would get these all the time versus, and I'm sure we've said this before, what we would get now, which would be a 7-part limited series, which is like not always warranted. In fact, rarely is.
Yeah. And the, like, even this is sort of like, it's not even based on a book. So like, it's so funny to watch a, you know, a network property trying to contend with these issues. And like, there are certain things that they really can't get into, like this sort of generational suicidal ideation that is going on that is never explicitly grappled with by either Lucas on screen.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff glossed over about, like, I'm not sure how much of this is based on real life events, but they're sort of like, well, you know, Lorette used to sleep around because she had been assaulted as a child, which is like, that was the shorthand that used to be used to get a sexually free lady character to get you on their side, which is dumb.
For sure. She also says she calls it a defect that he can't see, and it's that she is infertile. And the implication is that there was an abortion that went wrong. I mean, that's what I read into it. That was what happened.
Right. In real life, she was, Olivia was not able to have children. I'm not sure exactly what the situation was. I feel like this Washington Post piece, if that were the case, would not have scrupled to say so. And I don't think it does, but it's in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, there's only so much that you can do with these stories, because so much of the time, like, there's a reason that I have a whole tag in the bookshop that's hashtag just get a divorce, because
yeah.
And then sometimes they do, and it still doesn't matter. Like, right. You know, the Betty Broderick industrial complex, notwithstanding. But it is funny to watch sometimes these older properties and be like, there isn't actually quite enough to support a book here. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Like 25 or 30 years ago, the true crime book trade was sort of in the same place that we are with these movies and series now, which is like, sometimes it should just be a Vanity Fair article and then just leave it there.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably the case here, but it's fascinating to see good professional actors figuring out, like, what is the actual issue?
Mm-hmm.
Here. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, it's not like scandalous, gory death.
Yes.
It's the, you know, the tension of these roles.
Yeah.
In small towns anywhere, I think, mm-hmm. and trying to get out of your lane and, you know, gender essentialist bullshit, and that you do marry the family. And I think they did a good job. It just needed to be 50 minutes and not 84.
I agree with that. And there's also a thing about, like, there's I shouldn't say they're all the same, because these TV movies, there are two kinds. One where the murder happens right away, mm-hmm. or the crime, and one where it happens almost at the very end. And then this one is, I mean, spoiler, I guess, this is the latter, because he's not a criminal mastermind. I mean, again,
no.
Burning the corpse on a pyre when people are, like, walking past him to go have a picnic. I mean, not literally, but they could be.
But
like, he's
kind of.
Yeah. He's
like,
in the middle of
the shot, they're shooting something else.
Right.
They're shooting, like, Lonesome Dove 2. Right. And it's like, guys.
Yeah. On. Yes. So, you know, he quickly gets caught and then he's in prison and that's the end. And it's sort of like that has its pleasure. I mean, pleasure is the wrong word. That's satisfying in its own way, where it's just like, the story isn't the crime. The story is what drove him, air quotes, to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they earned it. I felt like they did. Like, it did by the end feel inevitable. Like, they were not going to escape.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And there was definitely a rising tension. And also the fact that, like, she was just pool sharking to raise money.
Yeah.
Was like, oh, mm-hmm. sliding doors.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely check out the show notes for these, for the obituaries of both Big Ralph and Ralph III, because it's like, how do you get from Camden, New Jersey to literally run a plantation in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
as Big Ralph did? And then how do you, like, you're caught for this murder, you're sentenced for this murder, you're paroled after like 7 years, and then you die at 45 of a heart attack. Like, I mean, sometimes the story around the story is like the best part, like these just little trivial facts. But Layton is good, because Layton is always good, mm-hmm. In these things. Bonnie Bartlett is hateful, and which is excellent, because she doesn't usually play characters like this, I wouldn't say.
Yep.
And the rest of it is kind of just a nothing burger. Like, I, you know, just read the Washington Post piece and you're good to go.